Hello, welcome once again to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay. With me as always is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm doing well. I'm really glad we don't live in Prohibition era Mississippi.
Why?
Seems like a rough place.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And since we are covering a film that is nominated for Best Picture among one of its 16, record-breaking 16 nominations, we've thrown it back to the days of Real Ripe and Real Rotten and invited Wes on to join us. Wes, how you doing?
I'm good. Good to be back. Honestly, I'm actually a little bit scared since I haven't recorded a podcast in a long time, but I am here to talk about, resurrecting what we used to do on that Real Ripe show and just talk about are you guys actually doing the worst and the best this year, or are you just talking about this one just because it's apropos of the time?
Just this one because it's, you know, coming up.
Is this one the best? Do you know that off the top?
That's a good question.
It's fairly
the
high,
best,
right?
The best for Coogler?
Well, when we did Real Ripe, it was we did the highest rated Best Picture nominee and the lowest rated Best Picture nominee of the year.
Mm.
This one's at 97%, I think. So
it is.
It's pretty high.
It's a rare one where it's the first one in a while we've had pretty much an even split where it's 97% Rotten Tomatoes and 96% viewer or whatever the other thing is called. Audience.
Yeah, wow.
Audience.
And it is number 12 on our list, which, yeah, it's good. I don't know if it's that, but it's good. continues to confound this list. And if you want to help and support our show, check out what we're doing over on Patreon, over at patreon.com/thepenskyfile, where you can follow Amanda and myself as we go down the sequel highway this year. Wes, you're super excited. I hope you are, because we're doing Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2. So that means you get drafted back into
Didn't we do that already?
No, we did three.
We did three. Okay, we just skipped two for some reason. Good.
That
good
was such wishful thinking on your part.
What month of the year is that?
Oh, we haven't picked it yet. It's going to be totally random.
Yeah, make sure it's nice and hot.
Yeah. But yes, we are, of course, talking today about Sinners, the from 2025. Wes, had you seen this before?
No, I had not. I only knew that I knew very little about this, only that it existed. I had heard the name. And that's it. So I went in completely blind to what it was.
Oh, excellent. Cool. So was the midway genre turn a surprise to you?
I knew it was supposed to be a horror movie. So I knew that something was going to happen. And it did. And we'll talk about that. But no, it was really like this is maybe the only, I've completely tapped out of the movie culture at this point. And this was the only Best Picture nominee that I think I've heard of at this point. So it made an impression in that way for me. Maybe I know what's the Leonardo DiCaprio movie? Was that one nominated?
It was One Battle After Another.
Maybe I know that one. So I know these two, but yeah, I knew nothing about this one. So my opinion is, that of someone who, in this day and age, might be a rare case of someone not knowing anything about what a movie is before they see it.
Cool. That's
excellent. Because I feel like this far out, it was kind of hard to go into it not having the twist kind of ruined. But
yep.
Amanda, what about yourself? Did we see this together?
I'm pretty sure we did.
I think we did.
I can't remember what theater, but I'm pretty sure we did. I think a few of us went and saw this one.
Yeah, I forget which one too, but I can't remember if we saw it. I think we saw it in IMAX. Maybe it was probably.
I think we did too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So regardless, I have seen this is the third time I think I've watched it.
Okay.
Oh, Wes, I just looked it up. So the top rated one is a movie called The Secret Agent, which was one of the ones I had not heard of. That's a 98% with only an 84% audience score. But and the lowest is F1, which is an 82.
I'd heard of that one too. Okay.
Yeah, F1 is the one movie on there where I'm like, it was fine, but why?
Yeah. Yeah. There was nothing wrong with it as a movie.
It's enjoyable,
but
it's a good time.
I don't understand why it's nominated for Best Picture.
Hey, get ready for my take about this movie.
Uh-oh.
Oh, boy.
I had a feeling.
Yep.
All right. Well, with that in mind, then, we're going to take a quick break. We'll play the trailer for you, and then we're going to get down to it.
I've been all over this world. I've seen men die in ways I ain't even know was possible. Love you, brother. Be careful. I will. With all the things that I've seen, I ain't ever seen no demons, no ghosts, no magic. Till now.
You get back inside.
Let me in, man! Shit going on out here.
You keep dancing with the devil.
You gotta let me in. Let me in. Let me in. You gotta let me in.
One day he's gonna follow you home.
Okay, Sinners, written and directed by Ryan Coogler, starring Creed from Creed, Jimmy from 28 Years Later, Kate Bishop from Hawkeye, Agent B-15 of the TVA, Miles Caton, Omar Benson Miller, Jamie Lawson, Yao, Helena Hugh, Delroy Lindo. You know, I was looking for another thing, like a character to continue the bit for Delroy Lindo, because he's one of those guys who's like in everything, but yeah. I couldn't find anything that I was like, oh yeah, that guy, like that character.
You say that man's name, it has a badass name. You call him by his,
yeah, you don't need a character for him.
That is true. And the entire,
it's kind of like a Star Wars name in a lot of ways.
Like, it does sound like, yeah, a Star Wars kind of. And the entire recorded history of African American music. Amanda, what happens in Sinners?
Trying to leave their troubled lives behind, twin brothers return to their hometown to start again, only to discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, more or less.
Yes. That vague enough to be true with that description.
Yes. which is all you can hope for with these summaries. A lot of them are factually incorrect.
Yeah, the AI is getting better at developing how you summarize a film in one sentence.
Well, at least it summarized the right film.
Yep,
that's true. Yeah. Well, Clay, Wes, some things you'll find in Sinners include Chicago, a city that ain't nothing but Mississippi with tall buildings instead of plantations.
You know, that's what I constantly tell people, and people just look at me weird when I say it. So
I always
that
tell
would be
people,
a weird thing to say.
I always tell people my black ass got blown down here, too, and they never really understand what I'm talking about.
Cunnilingus tutorial.
Yeah, surprisingly a lot of that in this movie.
Yeah.
Twist. Going into this, it's not the vampires, it's the shocking amount of
the preoccupation with oral sex.
Yeah, oral sex explainers.
Yeah. Yes. Say what you will about Coogler, but he clearly loves eating pussy. I feel like I don't want to lose that, because I feel like that's kind of an important thing, but I'll put a pin in it that. And I'll come back to it.
Okay.
Literally.
All right, great.
Does it, it's like
totally
this movie,
lost my place on the
this
page.
This movie was made specifically for DJ Khaled, I think.
Well, I let's get into it now. Actually, for how graphic they got, I thought his tip was shit.
It was the early days; they hadn't figured it all out yet.
That's like level 101 level. Don't do it too hard. Like, that's the best you got. Like, give me something better than that. At least Seinfeld gave you like the swirl.
To be fair, they did not have television or the internet or any way to like. There's no foundational knowledge to begin with, so this really it should be 101, right?
I mean, but what, like, that couldn't have been popular in 1930s Mississippi Delta culture.
That's why he's got to spread it word of mouth, literally.
Yeah.
Spread.
Mouth.
All right, we'll come back to it. But I think that's kind of like it's a weird, interesting little point about this movie that I was thinking about quite a bit.
It does remind me a little bit. I don't know why this always sticks in my head, but there's a stupid South Park episode where they were bragging about knowing how sex works. And I think Cartman was like, yeah, you just, you know, you put it inside her, you move it around, and then you take it outside and you pee on her leg.
Yeah, being.
Speaking of which, this movie also includes dick jokes and dead children.
Sure does.
Yep.
Yep. Dick jokes, dead babies, everything
both sides
you like
of the human experience.
What's everything. The dick joke?
They just make references to dick size and okay. You know, it just sounded nice.
Gotcha.
I mean, there is one.
There's a dead child. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes. And there is one moment where Stack tells Cornbread that if he takes this job, his wife might even let put his pecker in her mouth. So
yeah, there you go. Yeah. Dick jokes.
Kind of a dick joke.
In contrast to cunnilingus, a threat.
Yes.
The blowjob is a threat, where the cunnilingus is something that everyone should talk about.
Disgusting. I agree with this.
I need to speak to the Academy about what they've done to the youth of America.
Well, on a more wholesome note, you'll also find haggling over sign making prices.
Yeah, you honestly learn a lot of stuff in this movie. Like, I know it's all very 101 stuff, but Sammy's a very 101 kind of character. He's going out into the world for the first time, but it's also good because not a lot of people know that if someone offers you money, the first thing you do is ask for more.
Yeah.
In any situation in life.
Yeah. You'll also find Native American...
I think that's why my nonprofit never got off the ground, though. Because anytime people would donate, I would automatically ask them for $50 more.
Isn't that how all the like political fundraising
works,
basically.
Though?
That's how every interaction at any store is like, do you want to tip me for doing absolutely fucking nothing? It's like, no, that's fine. We'll stick with the price.
Have you noticed? I mean, the tip things are whatever as they stand. But all of the ones that have the preset ones, none of them start at 15. It's always like it starts at 20% and goes up. And it's like, buddy, come on. Give me a break.
It's outrageous. And you have to hit other. You have to go through multi-clicks to like put it to a bit lower or whatever it is.
In my day, when you go to a bar and you have a drink and you get a drink, you leave a dollar for a tip.
You have a dollar.
I'm not giving you 25% tip on a $30 drink bill.
We're getting too far into Old Man Yells at Cloud Corner. Rein it in,
just,
guys.
Just imagine them talking about a sign to make it thematically appropriate. Yeah. I'm not paying that for a sign. I'm paying that. All the guy did was paint the sign and stand there. He didn't do anything with it. I bagged my own sign.
She didn't even bring her own wood. She painted it on the building.
Bagged my own sign. Well, you'll also find Native American vampire hunters.
Yeah. I have things to say about them.
In a movie
good
about racism, it's good to generalize that Native Americans have the outlook on life and the spirituality and vampire hunting that we all know that they do as people. Yeah.
Common knowledge, 101 stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You'll also find racial violence reminisces with complete with audio accompaniment.
Yeah, that was a weird one when Delroy Lindo is telling his story. I think it's Delroy Lindo is telling the story about the guy spending all his money to open up something, and then he ends up getting lynched. And in the background, it's just like whip noises and screaming, and then the audio of a person being hanged.
That's rough.
Interesting audioscape in that scene.
You'll also find salivophilia.
Yeah, I had to look that up. I was expecting a more interesting word, actually.
For, I was too.
Yeah, for spitting in someone's mouth.
Yeah.
The Pornhub titles have different words they use. I don't think they get so technical as that.
The scientific term is, yeah.
Is it actually salivophilia? Like that's I thought you made it up with how clunky that sounds.
No, I looked it up, and that's it's actually really funny because the explanation actually says something like, while there is no exact term for this fetish, most people refer to it as spitting in your mouth.
Thank you, Urban Dictionary.
Then at the bottom it says also known as salivophilia.
I was making her clap cheeks, and then I salivophilia'd all over the place.
Oh my god! You'll also find an ominous song about herbs.
Mm-hmm. Yep, as all herb songs are.
As all herb songs are. The most terrifying thing of all: unexpected white people.
Even in my own home, if I catch my reflection in the wrong way, it scares the shit out of me.
And last, but certainly not least, fellowship and love.
Mm-hmm. Got to have it. Okay, Sinners. Well, let's jump right in. Wes, why did you not like this movie?
I'm you guys tell me, you seem to be the opposite. You guys tell me why you liked this movie. I will say, here's how I'll lead this off with my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that there's like Academy Award inflation, like there are new categories every year that like allow films to get more and more nominations for things. Like this one got nominated for Best Casting, which is a new category this year.
How do you even quantify that?
Yeah. I actually was thinking about it. I think that's kind of fair. Like you could have a movie that wins Best Actor and the rest of the cast could be horrible in it. And this one's more of like who generally casts their movie the best.
Oh, yeah,
like,
okay.
Who did the best job of, like, as a production, who made the movie cast sing? But, like, I understand that there's this kind of inflation with nominations, but... And I also understand that the movies that were the record holders before this, I don't think any of them are timeless classics in that way. Like, Titanic is one. Like, La La Land is another one.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't really think that this matters all that much, but I have to push back on this movie just because it got a record-breaking amount of nominations. And it basically won every single category. And that doesn't make any sense to me, really. Like, Jordan being nominated for Best Actor is like a joke, in my opinion. That really, like, we'll get into that. But that's where I'm coming from. I didn't think this movie was bad. I didn't think it was great. If I had not known anything about its Oscar nomination success, I would have just walked away going, that was an okay movie for 2025. I wouldn't think anything of it after that. But I'm interested what you guys thought. Like, if you think it's a Best Picture nominee, I'm curious, and I would ask that you guys actually start first.
Well, I would say, so I was surprised that it got a Best Picture nomination, because usually this isn't the kind of thing that they go for. But with that in mind, I'm glad that it did get that, because I do think that this is a pretty unique movie in the not just the subject matter is tough, right? Because I mean everybody it's one of those things where I think, well, how come this movie is so lauded when it does the exact same thing that From Dusk Till Dawn did like 25 years ago, and everybody I know who watched that movie was like, I thought it was really good until the vampires showed up.
Yeah,
and I think there's a reasonable answer to that, but it's a very unique movie, specifically from the way that it uses music, and I was trying to think of another movie that uses music as well as this movie does, or in the way that this does, and the only other thing I could think of was The Wicker Man, something that isn't quite a musical, but has music folded in and woven into it in a very specific sort of folk horror kind of way. The fact that they've nominated a folk horror movie for Best Picture, I think, is pretty incredible. I think the cinematography is absolutely amazing. I think it's one of those movies that really shows you how much better things look when they shoot it on film. Because this is, I think it's just top to bottom, it looks great. The Jordan being nominated, I think Jordan, I probably wouldn't, he probably wouldn't be the first one on my list, but I understand the choice because he's playing the two twins who are, you know, fairly unique. I think the special effects are more impressive than his performance because it's the most it's the most seamless twin effect that I've ever seen in a movie. If you watch the behind the scenes stuff, I was kind of chuckling because it goes into all of the technical stuff that they had to do to pull this off, including building a custom camera rig that he could wear over his head that had like 25 cameras in it that would capture his performance from every possible angle, which they would then feed into the computer and create a digital mask that they could put onto the other actor, the stand-in, blah, blah, blah. And in my head, I'm like, I mean, I don't know, or you could just like split the frame in half like they did on Star Trek.
Like, not to be too cynical, or you could just completely not have it be two characters because there's no reason for there to be two characters in this movie. Like,
well, I think the fact that one of them becomes a vampire makes it pretty important.
Which one is which? Who's Smoke?
Smoke is the one who is not a vampire.
What's his personality?
Very tightly wound, very practical, and detail-oriented.
Full of grief, grief and PTSD.
Yeah, there you go.
Do you think that comes across in all series? Like, do you think that this performance makes you feel like these are two different characters?
Oh, definitely. I think so. Yeah, really? I think they're very different. Because, I mean, what's the other one? Stack? Stack is much more flamboyant and much more...
He's like the showman and the salesman.
Yeah.
Of the two.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the scene where they kind of get into an argument over whether or not they should take plantation money is fairly indicative of the difference between them, because Smoke is very practical in understanding that they are not going to make money unless they take real money, whereas Stack is more about creating. He's thinking about the next time people show up and making sure they have a good time, and he's more interested in the spectacle of it.
Yeah, I think he's kind of the people person. Like, he enjoys the being the center of attention. He wants to draw people in. But I actually like that Smoke and Stack seem so tied. Like, I think they are distinguished characters, but they are so tied together because they are deeply codependent, which is, sure, like, what sets up the tension once one of them becomes a vampire, where it's not just like, all right, let's fucking kill all of these things. It's like, well, no, that's still my brother. He's my other half. Like, they both say at different times, like, things like, there is no me without him.
Right.
And so I think that, like, intense bond between them is part of the point. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I watched this movie, and I don't really think that it was necessary. Like, I understand that one becomes a vampire or whatever, but, like, the things that the movie is saying does not depend on there being two brothers that you go through this ridiculous production process to... You couldn't just have them be separate actors at that point. Like, a lot of this feels like you're just trying to do something technical for no particularly good reason. And I walked away with the impression that, like, I couldn't tell you which one was which by the end of the movie, and I thought that their personalities were so similar to the point that it also didn't matter that I couldn't tell which one was which when I was watching it. Like, at no point was my understanding of the movie or, like, scene deconstruction swayed by me not caring about which one was talking at that point. I didn't really get why you made this decision to make this incredible amount of work for yourself, ultimately in a movie that... They could have just been different actors from each other. They could have been different people, and it wouldn't have changed anything for me.
Yeah. What do you think, Amanda?
I mean, I'm still kind of standing by my feeling that it does have like a thematic impact of them being two sides of the same coin kind of deal. Like, because I do think not to jump straight into like big capital T themes right away, but I think this movie is very much drawing out the comparison between like Sammy's father as a religious leader and Remick the vampire as a religious leader, and mm-hmm. how they're both promising a type of salvation, one light, one dark, and both of them, Sammy ends up rejecting both of them. Both options kind of fail at the end. Mm. And I think that's true of the brothers as well, is that they're both different people and they're trying to take different paths, but they kind of both fail at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say it is thematically, it is about kind of mirror images going all through it, even down mm-hmm. to the even down to the music styles and the scene towards the end where Remick where Sammy is saying the Lord's Prayer and then Remick mm-hmm. starts saying it with him. And basically starts saying like, yeah, no, my people are just like your people. We got those words forced on us just like you did. You know, that's one of the things I find so interesting about what they're doing musically. Mm-hmm. Because they are making this comparison. They are kind of, the thing that is the most surface level thing that they're doing with the music seems to be essentially playing out the fate of black music in America, which is black music is its own thing until the white guys come along and they steal it, like a vampire would suck your blood. But
Remick literally says,
I agree that that's like one of the main things of the movie. What does that mean? Like, who's stealing the music?
Well, I mean, he specifically says to Sammy, he says, I want your memories, I want your songs, and I want you to have mine. And I think that's the thing where it gets a little muddy, because I think that the reason I said it's the surface level thing is because I don't think it's as simple as that. I think it is trafficking in a bit more nuance about the blending of these two things than it is straight up that it's Elvis stole rock and roll from B.B. King or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what this movie is saying about that, really. Like, I think this movie has a lot of things that it's saying in a way that I personally feel is kind of a jumble. But I mean, like if you wanted to start off into the type of theme stuff, like is this movie about cultural appropriation, for lack of a better word? Is that kind of what they're talking about in this? Like, I see no other way to interpret the vampirism than it's a force that black culture feels that something has come and taken it from them. And taking it from them has ruined their own souls from that interaction. And
I think,
you guys feel like, is that what this movie is talking about? Like, I'm trying to, I feel like there's a haziness to a lot of the themes that I'm not exactly sure if that's the point that they're making or if they're trying to make something more convoluted than that. But that's the one that's most strongly comes across to me, is that there is this like constant struggle between groups to steal each other's souls. and I don't know if that work, that like layering on, that onto a music theme really doesn't work for me at all. But I mean, like, do you guys disagree with that take? Is that what the movie's saying to you? Or do you think they're saying something else that I'm missing?
What were you saying, Amanda?
I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to quibble with like your terms, Wes, but I don't know if I'd say it's exactly cultural appropriation so much as it is oppression. And like the two cultures it's obviously like pointing to in the music are like Irish folk songs and African-American like blues music. And the similarity that Remick the vampire is pointing out between them is in both cases, either you were stolen from your homeland and forced into this society and forced to leave your culture behind and forced to assimilate, and you lost pieces of your soul because of that, and you're trying to hold on to what little you have left. Mm-hmm. And in Ireland, there was this, you know, not the same, but a similar situation where the English came in and colonized and kind of tried to stamp out Irish culture. And I think it's more pointing to those than just less of a direct, like, white people are trying to come in and take what you have, but more of they're trying to make you like them.
Yeah,
and the irony,
right? But
is
why are the white vampires in this movie usurping black blues music?
I think for Remick, it's because he thinks they are already the same. Like he thinks, we're both oppressed people, and I'm going to bring you into my fold, and then we'll be together, and we'll just share everything. And that's, you know, the irony is that it is just another kind of worse form of oppression and absorbing another culture for your own benefit. And I think that's why, like, the vampires, you know, are the bad guys, is they are just, like, re-perpetrating this cycle upon people.
Yeah. And I would say, I think for me, what makes the vampires work is that the whole first half of the movie is really establishing and laying out the environment and community that these people have created, all the people of color, whether it's the black people or the Chinese people, inside this Jim Crow era oppression. And inside that, they're still creating their own sense of community, and they're trying to build this thing for that group of people that celebrates the stuff that, you know, they want to celebrate. And even that they can't stop from someone from the outside coming into. And I was watching it last night. The thing that actually stood out to me the most was when Remick and the other two show up, basically they use the line, I can't remember the exact line, but it's something along the lines of what was it you said, what was the last thing you'll find, Amanda?
Fellowship and love.
Yeah, they're using that in a situation where they want something, whereas every other time you in any other instance in the movie, white people they're either Klan guys or they are wardens, and they're complete assholes and they're violent. But the second that the people they're oppressing want to have something for themselves, then it becomes, oh, well, how come we all just can't, you know, hang out together? And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
Oh, just that it also kind of echoes the, like, religious colonization of a lot of different cultures, like, throughout history, where the excuse of, you know, when they settled North America and Central America, it was, well, we're going to bring them Jesus. We're going to bring them God. We're going to save their souls. Like, we can't not give them Christianity, because then they'll be damned to hell. So, like, we're here to help. We're the good guys.
Right.
It doesn't, you know, I think they're definitely playing with that, too, with all the religious themes throughout the whole movie.
That being said, Wes, I know what you're talking about. Because watching it last night, one of the things that I was thinking about was, if you read it as a music, a metaphor through music, in the way that it's about the way black music has been co-opted by white artists over the years, I don't know if that completely tracks. I think. And I was trying to decide whether or not that matters, because I think more so that might just be a starting point of thinking about that stuff versus just a one-to-one metaphor that runs through the entire thing.
You mean tracks in the movie?
Yes.
Like, because I don't believe in this idea of cultural appropriation as, like, if we're talking about, like, whites having co-opted black music. I don't really know what that means, because like all culture is just a mix of cultures interacting with each other. So like there is no innately white or innately black culture to things. Like they develop things like technologies and music and stuff like that. But this idea that like other cultures aren't allowed to use what other cultures create is like completely like untethered from reality and how it works. Like there's no way that you can completely isolate these things and say that, like, what's the real world situation of white people co-opting black music? And like when they, in, you could say something like Elvis, right? But do you, are you, is the insinuation there that Elvis was cynically taking music from people?
He might or not have been, but there were plenty of other people who did. It's a pretty well documented thing that the
what's the cynicism of it, like that they saw something that people wanted and enjoyed and they marketed it? Is that like what's how is it used in a nefarious way is my question.
Well, they would very specifically have these black artists who would record songs that they weren't paying very much money, and then they would just turn around and have white artists record the exact same songs and put those out to, and be specifically because they didn't want to market black music to white people.
Right, but I don't think that's the same. That, like, that's a totally different argument than what the movie is making. The movie is saying that the essence of the music itself is like sort of spiritually bound to people, and if someone comes in and takes it from you, it's the movie's not arguing about like bad recording deals or like bad, like unfair business practices or just like outright racism in denying people their access to like what they created. It's making much more of a music is so tied spiritually to someone's soul that unless you're given permission to come in, it's not right for them to reference it or use it or want to be a part of it. Isn't that what the movie's saying? Like, there's no sense of like, there's no sense of what music really is, which is that all music is kind of like other people taking inspiration from other things and other cultures and making new music with it. So I don't really understand where the argument starts that this is the wrong thing to do. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't think it's a, I don't think it's one or the other. I think you can do exactly what you're saying and have it be completely, or have it be not a cynical way of doing it. For instance, like one of the things I was reading that they point out is that Remick's instrument is a five-string banjo. Five-string banjo is originally an African instrument that then got worked into Appalachian music. And like that is more, much more of a natural progression than I think the way that other things, the way that music can be co-opted and stolen and capitalized on, erasing the people who originally wrote it. Like that, like I, you know, as much as,
but,
go ahead.
Okay, sorry, go ahead. Well, I just like who, like, I guess how far does this go? Like, was there ever, like, I understand a kind of like people will buy, like Benny Goodman is a good example, right? Like Benny Goodman is performing black swing jazz music, right? But he wasn't going out there and saying, he wasn't taking that music and saying like, I've come up with this thing. Like people knew what he was doing. But it was during a kind of a much more racist period in history where white audiences felt more comfortable buying from white artists, right? Like that's the difference. Benny Goodman had no insidious, nefarious means of being like, I'm going to steal their music and I'm going to cap. Like there's no one like Elvis and all them. No one gets into this black music for cynical reasons. They get into it because they love the music because it's great. So I don't, there's no like nefarious point to it.
I don't think that's a complete blanket statement to make though. Cause I think
I also,
sorry, Amanda, go ahead.
No, I just, I think specifically in this movie, though, like, these characters in this plot, they're sharecroppers, and they have nothing, really. Like, they don't own the land they're working on. They don't even, you know, kind of own the profits of the work that they do. They have to reach their quota every day.
Yep.
And I think in the movie, specifically, I'm not a music historian. I can't speak broader than the, you know, 120 minutes that I watched last night. There is a white person who is trying to take and co-opt Sammy's music specifically in a nefarious way. Like, Remick wants Sammy because he wants his ability to connect with, you know, the spiritual level, these ancestors, whatever. He doesn't have it, and he wants it, and he is going to take it from Sammy by force to use for himself.
Right.
So I don't know. I can't really speak in a broader historical societal context, but I do think that if that's the message in this movie specifically for these characters, like, that's, you know, there is like an attempt at a hostile takeover here, and an attempt to take what little a very impoverished and very oppressed people have and take it away from them.
Yes. Like, I'm totally fine with the movie saying such a thing, but I have a hard time not extrapolating that into a larger point that they seem to be, like.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the not to jump all the way to the epilogue, but the sort of like little post-credit scene with older Sammy when he's, you know, it's like 1992 or whatever.
Yeah, Buddy Guy playing older Sammy.
Yeah. But I think it's great because it shows that he went out and he got out of that environment and he did share his music with the world and clearly was very successful. It looks like it's his club that he owns. Like, he's lived a long, full life and he has put his music out there and I'm sure inspired a lot of different types of people. So I don't know if the movie is trying to say, like, this music is a closed system. Like, you can't touch it. You can't have it. I think it's more like, what are the conditions in which this music is being produced? Like, is it Remick coming in and essentially trying to, like, take over Sammy physically and force him to do stuff? Or is it Sammy putting his music out there and offering it to the world? Because those are very different things.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's a difference between an artist who is honestly just a fan and loves the music and the person who is trying to exploit that. Like, if you look at Elvis, right? Elvis always gets the most crap for appropriating black music, et cetera, et cetera. But if you read one Wikipedia article about Elvis, you'll read that that's the stuff he grew up listening to, like you were saying, Wes. Yeah. Like, that's the music that he loved. He wasn't trying to steal anything. However, the people like Colonel Tom, who are trying to make money, don't give a shit about that. And they are more than happy to co-opt and exploit, and who gives a shit about the other people? Like, if it was all in the name of artistic community, Willie Dixon wouldn't have to sue to get his name put on Whole Lotta Love that completely lifts stuff from his you know what I mean? Like, I think there's definitely a line where there are people who are doing it completely, who are doing it, what's the word I'm looking for? From a good place, but there are definitely other people who are there to steal it and co-opt it and exploit it. And I think that's where Remick, like, if Remick didn't sing, I think that would be a little cleaner. Because if Remick was just someone who was trying to co-opt and, because I think there's a little bit that you can kind of parse out about how long he's been around. And maybe even like what he was before, because he when he talks about the Lord's Prayer, he said mentions his father he basically insinuates that he's like 1600 years old or something. You know, which he does specifically talk about being Irish, but like if he I don't I'm kind of trying to formulate this idea as I'm talking, so I'm not really doing a very good job. But like, I think Remick, if Remick was more of a cipher than an active participant, I think that might be a little bit cleaner of a metaphor, you know? Because like,
yeah,
when they all start doing the big Irish song, Rolling Down to Dublin, mm-hmm. or whatever it's called.
That's insensitive to my people, Clay.
Hey, it's my people, too.
How dare you?
I can say it. It's my people, that's too.
That's the one where after they've absorbed a little bit of blues.
Basically everybody else who was in there has left, and they all got turned into vampires. And they're just doing explicitly an Irish thing. Like, part of me, I was thinking, like, I don't know, I feel like this should be pretty awesome, shouldn't it? If you're blending these two things together, but they all just become Irish. So.
Right, yeah. I think that's why, like, I think that's why, like, when I watch this movie, I gravitate much more, like, all right, I love the music in this movie. I think it's amazing. It's really cool. I like the music scenes in this a lot. But I always find myself gravitating more and having more interest in the religious themes because I think they're better fleshed out, and I think they make more sense. Like, I personally can kind of see more what I think the movie's trying to say about, like, religious indoctrination and how these two things are kind of the same side of a coin, where the very opening scene, I completely forgot this, that... when it starts with Sammy arriving at the church before we jump back in time, as he walks up the aisle to his father, it keeps intercutting with scenes of Remick. Mm. And it's drawing this like explicit comparison between Remick and Sammy's father. And I think that's part of why I go more in that direction when I watch this movie, and I pay more attention to those things, because I think that message and that theme is a little more interesting and a little more fleshed out to me, and I can kind of parse it better, because I think you're both right, where the stuff about the music in this movie is really interesting, but it does kind of start to fall apart when you get into the Irish of it all.
Sorry, is the theme about the religion just the fact that he's torn between two worlds of the Christianity not saying that the music is the right thing to do, and... what would Remick's point in that be? So what's the other what's the other side of the religious coin? Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, no. I think Remick is a pastor of his flock. Yeah. Right? Like he's the brain, he's the heart, he's the leader. And the more he absorbs people from the juke, from the party, they become a congregation in the same way that Sammy's father is the pastor of his community, and therefore kind of the leader and the person who is setting the tone and telling people right from wrong and what this is what we're going to do, this is what we're not going to do. And I think it's less maybe about the specifics of any given religion of, like, you know, Christianity or Satanism or whatever, and more just a Sammy coming to realize he has to kind of reject both sides of this, like, groupthink.
Yeah.
And go find his own life elsewhere.
Yeah, because even you know, he sees playing the blues at a juke joint as the thing he wants to do, and even the guys he looks up to, i.e. the Smoke Brothers, what the hell are their names?
The twins, just the twins. Call them the twins.
I think it's Smoke specifically who is like, no, you're not going to do this. And he's like, no, I am. And he's like, if you do this, I'm literally going to kill you.
yeah, I will actually kill you.
And so even there, you know, he's being rebuffed by the people that he thought he could really rely on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that what I like about the movie is this idea that, you know, music is like... how best does this go? Hey, have you guys seen the Commitments movie?
No.
So the Commitments is like an early 90s movie. It's probably one of my favorite. It's a personal favorite of mine. It would make probably my personal, like, top 20. It's not a great movie, but it's about this group of Irish. It's very similar to this, actually, except for the vampires. But it's this group of Dubliners who... it's shot in Ireland. Whole Irish cast that are largely musicians rather than actors. And the movie is about, like, these Dubliners start a soul band in Dublin, like, as a way to sort of, like, make a little bit of extra money and, like, get through the economic doldrums of what must have been, like, the late 70s, early 80s era for them. And what I love about the commitments is that it is so the actors themselves perform the songs and they had the soundtrack and everything. So they do these covers of soul classic standards like Mr. Pitiful, In the Midnight Hour, Dark End of the Street and stuff like that. But they do all these covers. And the movie is really this bare bones plot that gives you a chance to watch them perform the music in various situations. And they make a point in that movie that soul music is perfect for Irish because the Irish are the blacks of Europe. And that's like a line from their like takeaway about why they're doing this and stuff like that. But my problem with this movie is that Coogler would seem to be saying that them playing this music that they love and they relate to is wrong because it's not their music in the first place. And my takeaway from this is that it's a group of kids who love music, love this kind of music. They don't do better than the original, but they do very decent covers of these songs. And it's a lot of fun, and it gives you the actual true power of music, which is that it's this very uniting, people like what they like. There's a way that it, like, it's the most primal art form that we have because no other art form makes you want to move to it. No other art form has a, like, physical reaction the way that music does. And it's why music is so important. And I just think that The Commitments does this better job of celebrating music than Sinners does. Sinners is claiming to be a celebration about music, but it's very exclusionary. And it's very much of, like, you draw lines in the sand between music styles and, like, different styles are not acceptable at the same time and only these people can play music. It's like, no, music's for everybody. People can love all the music that they want to do. No one's stealing shit from anybody. Like, it's very much a... You do what, like, the world, it's a very cynical take, I think, on the world to think that people are taking an art form that they love, or not that they love. People see an art form and their first instinct is, how can I monetize this for myself? I just don't think that's how music works. That's how record labels work, potentially. But record labels don't make the music. The artists make the music. And I don't know, I preferred a movie that's like, Sinners is at its best when it does that scene where they go through the history of, like, black, they do the dance hall scene where they start having, like, a George Clinton, like, guitarist appear out of nowhere and stuff like that. And I think that's a celebration of music right there. And that's what I was hoping more of the movie would focus on. And I feel like it just didn't want to do that. And it wanted to turn it into a theme that I frankly disagree with. I would agree with Amanda that I think, like, the Sinners thing of, like, all the other aspects going on, which is that, like, you know, it's like the crime of the brothers in Chicago coming back and trying to, you know, do the right thing. I think that all works better. I find the music to just be a colossal distraction in this. And actually, it's kind of contradictory in what I think. And I agree that the soundtrack is probably the best part of this movie. But the soundtrack is all about mixing musics together. And I don't understand how you can have a soundtrack that is explicitly designed to fuse music and to create fusions of music while having a plot that is built around the fact of being exclusionary about your style of music. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, if you look at that dance hall sequence, I would say that's, you know, that's not an exclusionary sequence. That's a sequence that has Chinese influence in it. And I think, you know, I think that's it. This is a movie that's specifically, I think, about the blues and the roots of the blues and black music as it was created in America in a very specific time.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And I think a large part of this movie is depicting the circumstances under which this music was created, and to show how much of an outlet at the time for the people this music was, only to have it kind of be sucked away and stamped out in a certain to a certain extent by the people that were oppressing them. And I don't necessarily disagree with your outlook on music and the culture sharing element of it, but I think for this specific story that he's telling, I think there, yeah. And I also don't entirely know that there is an exclusionary look at the music, because like you said, the soundtrack is very blended, and the most surprising moment in this movie for me the first time I saw it was when the three Remick and the two others show up for the first time, and mm-hmm. they go, "Well, we play music too," and they play that pick Poor Robin Clean song.
Yeah,
and then when they're done, so like as I'm watching the movie, I'm going like, I can't decide, is this supposed to be bad? Or is this supposed to be, oh, yeah, man, that's corny white people music? But when they're done, Delroy Lindo is like, I don't know, these guys are pretty good. Maybe we should let them
in.
Yeah. And so, I don't know if the blending of the music is ever explicitly presented as a bad thing. Because, like I said, once they all turn into vampires...
But the absorption is portrayed as bad. Once the vampires start turning blues people, like black people, into vampires, and they start absorbing some of the blues sound, that's a bad outcome in the story. But yeah, it's presented true. As that's the only way that you fuse music is by stealing it from people.
Go ahead,
Amanda. But I also had a similar thing of like. I wondered about that scene that you were talking about, Clay, because when you see that first performance of a traditional sort of Irish folk song, it comes across as very hokey. And I don't know if they shot it and were like, this is too strong of a criticism of this, because it felt very much like they added in reactions of that was pretty good in a way that wasn't naturally what the movie was saying, because that kind of flies in the face about what they're doing in the movie in terms of not letting them in at that
point. Well, but the next time that you see them play something is when Haley Steinfeld goes out in the one plot point I want to talk about that I think absolutely is insane. But the song that they do
there...
Not when
the guy gets shot in the ass and just walks away as if nothing had happened.
The song that they do there is legitimately beautiful. Like, there's no couching it as being hokey or like, oh, look at this dumb white music or anything. Like, it's legitimately good and is presented as such.
Can I interrupt with a very brief aside?
Yeah.
I find it hilarious that song has now had such a resurgence. Like,
which one?
The Mountain Time.
Oh, okay. The ballad.
The one that we're saying is very beautiful when Mary approaches them, because I was in Ireland a couple months ago, and I cannot tell you how many people in pubs or on street corners were singing that song for tourists who were all like, "Oh, it's so sweet," and all I could think of was like, you know, the drool hanging out of Remick's mouth. Scene happens.
See, that's the thing. This movie's actually about the greediness of the Irish busker.
Yeah.
It's got a real street problem. Doesn't it, like, I know, but you know why I think that happens in that? The movie seems to be saying there, Clay, is that the character who is mostly white views their music more prettily than the black people who see it as hokey. Right, like she's the character who's set up as has a grandfather or something who is black, and so she's mixed race but presents as white, and she's the character that out of all of them goes and sees them perform a very traditionally beautiful Irish folk song, which I think is a choice that they're making.
I
do think there's a lot to be said though, where this movie is about a specific time and a specific place,
but
right?
I think it's very stylized. Like, I don't think it's not like. Do you guys like the way that they act and they shoot and they like? To me, the essence of how stylized this thing is when they're driving through the cotton fields and it looks like a fantasy dream to me. Is that wrong? Like, You disagree about that? Like, do you not think that this is a very stylized portrayal of the Mississippi Delta of the time?
Oh, I think it's, I mean, it's definitely stylized, but I mean, it's, I think they're portraying plenty of actual things, maybe just not in the most horrible way they happen. Like,
they're choosing to elevate certain aspects. Like, it's very dreamlike in the first part. Like, I find the second half to be much more realistically shot than the first half is, even though the vampires are
interesting.
Like, it's very dreamy, very overly produced. Like, everything is pristine and clean, you know, in a way that it's not supposed to be. I understand it's a Hollywood movie and they do stuff like that, but it's just those cotton fields. It looks like a Marvel movie to me when they're riding through, like, Thanos should be stomping around in the background or something. But it's,
that would be really funny.
It's very, just even the way that the kid drives, like, the car perfectly smoothly. Like, this is a very idealized version of something that is not completely accurate to a faithful representation of it. So, like, I don't treat the story of the first half as particularly faithful to reality just because I think that it's filmed in a way that's not very faithful to that. And maybe, like, I think one of the big problems is the jump to the second half is so jarring because of that. But just because of that, like, I just see this as Coogler's sort of, like, idealized version of what was going on. And because it's idealized, he's deciding, he has a very strong thumb on the scale about what he's deciding to portray in the first half of the movie. But,
well, to hear him talk about it, I mean, his interest is he looks at what do I try to say? He has a very he is very interested in the people of that time as his ancestors.
Yep.
Being, you know, he sees them as giants to a certain extent. And so I can see his portraying that as a very kind of heightened stylistic way is, in I think, in line with how much reverence he has for those people. Like, one of the things that I noticed last night was at the end. So one of the things that Coogler talks about is how they decided to shoot on IMAX for this, which was basically he wanted to shoot it on 16mm, which is the smallest of the film stocks, until his producer was like, have you ever thought about shooting it on IMAX? And he was like, actually, that would be kind of fun. And so he's shooting it on IMAX, right? But the stuff, if you're watching it, I don't know if it does this on the stream. I was watching the 4K disc. But it does the thing where it changes aspect ratio depending on the stuff that's IMAX and the stuff that isn't. And one of the reasons he said he wanted to shoot on IMAX was to be able to present the people from this time and the people that he has this reverence for in such a larger than life kind of way. And I really picked up on that in the final sequence when the Klan guys show up, because they start cutting in these flashbacks to earlier in the movie where I think it's all sort of when they show up, when they're showing up to set up the juke joint.
Yeah.
And the way that they're cutting is completely inverse to the way I think most people would assume, where all of the big violence is shot letterbox and all of the moments of these characters interacting with each other are shot in IMAX. So those are the elements that get the bigger prestige format than just the, you know, the gunplay.
Yeah,
and I do think this is definitely, like, visually heightened and, like, narratively heightened on purpose, because the movie opens with this voiceover of Annie kind of explaining these rare, talented people in these specific cultures who have this power through music that can draw the attention of evil, even as it's a blessing. And it's done in this art style while she talks that is very, like, we are telling you, like, an oral tradition. This is like a folk tale or a fairy tale that we're embarking on for the rest of this. And I kind of forgot that was there. Like, I saw this movie when it came out and I haven't seen it since. So I completely forgot that it had that sort of art at the beginning.
Yeah, they use it for the voiceover to get the voiceover about the vampire lore out of the way, I suppose. Yeah.
That's actually not the vampire stuff. That's specifically about the
musicians.
But don't they? Or am I misremembering? Yeah, they talk about this to get
away from the metaphor stuff and just look specifically at the way this movie's put together. It came together. The script came together fairly quickly, and honestly, I feel like you can tell because
it's nominated for best screenplay, though, Clay.
Well, so I mean, I don't know if I would do that, but but like, I think if you look at this movie, it's a lot of big ideas that maybe aren't tied as tight as they could be.
Yeah.
One of which is they spend the whole movie having the Annie character with her hoodoo background and whatnot, talking about these, like, the concept of these hoodoo undead creatures. And then she goes, but it's actually just vampires.
Yeah,
like,
it's just a vampire.
Right.
Like classic movie vampires, which is fine. But like, if you're going to spend the whole time talking about this other thing and then she'd be like, actually, no, this is just vampires. That's a little weird.
Coupled with that like electric organ and chanting sting they have when like the moon comes out or when anything like vampire happens, it's like no, no, no.
And the other thing that really stands out to me is I think there are certain story beats that are only there, like that I feel like should have been things they came back to and trying to work out differently. The biggest one for me, which is actually kind of interesting because I do think it's one that shows the difference between Smoke and Stack, which is after Smoke tells Stack that they are they're basically underwater, they're not making any money because they're taking all this plantation money, they're talking about bringing in the vampire guys because they said they had money, and Smoke's reasoning for not wanting to do that is very sound, which is, well, yeah, it will be great until, you know, they come in and then one of their friends comes in and then maybe you look at one of them in a way that they don't like, and all of a sudden we're getting lynched or whatever, you know. It's a very practical, it's a very realistic way of looking at the situation. Whereas when Stack is on his own, he's like, maybe we should go check and see if those white people have money. And the fact that the entire thing hinges on Mary going out to see if these three Irish shit kickers have enough money to help them make their night is a little bit insane to me.
That was the scene you
thought.
Something
you should never do.
Yeah, the breaking. The gold coins too is the gold coins kind of struck me in that way, but like there was a kind of a strange, like it's a strange detail, I guess, that I don't really understand why they're included in the thing. But
I think it's just to imply that Merrick is, or Remick
is
old? Very old. Yeah.
Okay. I thought the Hates, is that what they call the,
yeah, something like
Hates.
That.
Yeah. I don't know why they, like, the movie is from dusk till dawn. At that point,
yeah,
like
I will say the reason I think this works better than From Dusk Till Dawn in that respect and is not as off-putting is because there is a horror element from the beginning, whereas From Dusk Till Dawn is literally just a Tarantino movie until Salma Hayek turns into a vampire, and then from that point on, you know, there's no foreshadowing or anything.
Do you think that they blend the two halves?
Say that again, sorry.
Do you think that the two halves blend? Like, is this an effective thing that they do?
I think that's probably why they structured the movie the way they did, where you get that beginning where it's Sammy bloody and beaten and traumatized, like driving into the church covered in blood with the broken off guitar neck. So that you know, like, oh, okay, something's going to go horribly wrong. Like, some real violence is going to happen. And then maybe, like, a third of the way through the movie, I think, is when you first see Remick. And he gets to their... He's chased by the Choctaw to their little shack.
Mm-hmm.
And we get that first scene with him. And then we kind of jump back away from him again. I think that helps blend the two halves. I think if this movie had just been like kind of straight up chronological and we didn't get to any of the vampire stuff until like, I don't know, an hour in, it might have been a little more jarring.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that the I thought the tonal shift was noticeable and kind of strange. Like I think that Jordan works better as an actor in the second half, and I think he's really quite weak in the first half. I think that everyone takes on more of a like that's a good actually point where I think Jordan is a bad nominee for best actor. So Jordan, in my opinion, is a little bit of a ham of an actor. And what he does in why I think that the rest of the cast is well done and well put together is that I believe all of the characters in the first half and the second half, except for Jordan's portrayal of them. So I believe like, is the woman's name Annie? Is that her name?
Yeah.
His, like the mother of his child. So yep. she's effective both as a kind of like Mississippi Delta sort of believes in like black spirituality with like sort of like a African tint to it, kind of like it's more of a traditional thing. And once the vampires come out, she completely switches effectively into modern actress playing in a vampire zombie movie.
Yeah.
And I think Delroy Lindo does the same. He's very believable as like the sort of down on his luck drunk harp player who just kind of kicks around in the Delta. But then he becomes basically the Ving Rhames character in every other movie later on.
Yep.
I don't think Jordan in the first half always feels, and in the second half, he always feels like an actor who's acting to me. Like he's always, he's playing a gangster. He's playing this thing. He's going to play the action hero. And it works in stuff like Killmonger because it's a comic book and Killmonger needs to be a little bit hammy and a little bit larger than life. And I think it works in that way. But here, I don't really buy him. And that's why I think he doesn't deserve the nomination. And I think he's actually the weakest actor out of the whole troupe just because he doesn't effectively convey the two halves. But I really feel there's a big difference in what kind of movie I'm watching between the two halves. And I noticed a lot of people were complaining about that. And I don't know if it's a problem as much as it's very noticeable. But I don't know if I'm... I don't know. I don't think it's... It doesn't ruin the movie, but it's a very weird shift that is almost so well done, except for Jordan, that it feels intentional to me.
It is a really strange shift. I mean, I don't know if... at least... I think it's I would say it's that kind of shift is 0-for-2 for not being jarring at all, because whether it's this or From Dusk Till Dawn, it's fairly jarring, you know. Because I do think that's another area where I feel like you maybe could have done another pass on the script, because it gets so modern actiony once the vampires show up, and it's then you start doing some like callbacks to other horror movies where they do the thing from The Thing where they're going around testing to see whether
garlic.
If any of them are vampires, and they're aping a couple shots from The Shining, which is always fun to see. But
that garlic sequence was a weird scene. That's a strange thing to put into the movie where they're chewing the garlic.
I think at that point it's kind of devolving a bit into what do we do with vampires? What's some fun stuff we can do with vampires more than it is anything
else? What tropes can we hit?
Yeah, and I think
do you think that them being such traditional vampires was the right thing to do?
I don't. That's what I mean about them just dumping the whole hoodoo dumping the hoodoo stuff and just going, oh, it's just vampires.
Because I find the hoodoo thing would have worked better. The hoodoo thing, because it's like, I mean, how far do you want to take the argument? Like, this goes with my entire point, is that like, it's sort of a version of cultural appropriation to just make them generic European vampires, right? Like, why not make it more of a cultural thing at that point with the hoodoos or whatever they're called? Like, I think
that you can use that concept to just kind of cover the concept of the vampire. You know what I mean? Like I don't see a need to delineate with a term as much as, like, it doesn't necessarily have to be specifically European vampires. It's just these things, these hoodoo creatures, they work the same way vampires do, you know? So,
well, that's what I'd be arguing. But at that point, it's a very European vampire thing, that with the garlic and the steak in the heart and stuff like that. That's what's coding them that way.
Yeah, and they're very traditional. I mean, at this point, they're basically post-Dracula vampires. So it's even more than just European. It's basically pop culture vampire. Which is, yeah, I don't know if they needed to make that hard of a turn with it, because I think you can still do most of that stuff and also open yourself up to some more interesting stuff that isn't so traditional by having it be, you know, using the hoodoo term to explain what these things are, even if that's not, you know, if they're not, even if they're not the literalization of the concept of the hoodoo monster. Does this make sense? I don't know if I make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, are you saying that, like, I think we're saying the same thing, basically, is like, I would have preferred a non-traditional vampire monster that they could call hoodoo, because I have no idea what a hoodoo is.
Yes, that's exactly what, like in what's that show? Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. How they call all the monsters the D&D names, but those, that's because that's what they know.
Yeah, it's just like a military code name for something.
Yeah, it's like they understand what a Demogorgon is. That's not the that's not this monster's Christian name.
Sure.
Right. It's like, isn't the final boss in Stranger Things? He's just like they keep being like, it's Vecna, and he's like, that's not my name.
I think why that's do you guys keep actually calling me that?
Yeah,
I think that kind of does actually happen in that show. So I do think it would maybe work better if they had stuck to calling them Haints.
Yeah,
I keep calling them Hoodoo. Sorry, the Haints. Whatever. I can't remember what their name is.
I think it would have benefited to be something a little bit more ambiguous as far
creative.
As like creative and ambiguous. Because like, I think they do really great stuff with some of the vampire stuff. I think the highlight of the vampire stuff is the scenes where people are trying to get into the juke joint. The various vampires. I think that stuff is great. But like,
the one with cornbread is so funny.
That's a traditional vampire thing, right? You have to invite them in. That's like
Yeah, I think so. I don't know where that comes from originally. I feel like I'd seen that.
Yeah.
It's in the in the sauce.
Yeah.
And like but like once Annie's like, no, these are vampires, and then it turns into like, let me set up my whiteboard presentation of how to deal with vampires. I get a little bit like, okay, could we just do something else here? Because then you cut to the outside, and you've got this like giant ring of vampires doing Irish folk songs. I'm like, that's cool.
Yes.
I don't care so much about whether or not a person can eat garlic. I'm more interested in the monsters with cultural music background.
Yeah,
it is also funny to me that they focus so much on the, like, you know, okay, these are vampires, and that means we need garlic, we need wooden stakes, we need I forget what else it goes from there, sunlight, and then when the big battle happens, they just end up shooting them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They get up.
Like, they do stake them, but they do end up mostly shooting them.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, all right.
I generally usually lose track and attention once sequences like that break out. It's always a big weakness for me. I really don't, like, I've seen a bajillion everyone gets attacked in the room sequences over the course of my life, and it's like nothing really adds to it. But very broadly, I mean, I understand it's two halves that make a whole, but I generally preferred the first half of the movie over everything else. I just felt like the shift into the second half with the vampires and everything was, as you're saying, it's like it's very traditional, very kind of expected as what's going on. And I think that they, if you're going to do anything interesting with the Smokestack Brothers, like, It just has no room to happen in the second half, and I guess you can get into it now. Like, what do you guys think about this kill the clan thing that happens at the end.
Both times of every time I've watched this, the first thing I think of is, why did they wait till the morning to show up?
Yeah.
Like, if if the idea was to kill everybody in the place, why would you show up after everybody's probably left?
Do they want to kill everybody?
Is the idea? Yeah, I was just going to ask that same question, well, Wes. Was the idea to kill everybody, or was it just to kill the twins?
I think it was just to kill the
land?
Twins and take the contract back, right?
My understanding was that it was to kill everybody, because Haley Steinfeld says that the one of the original three vampires, his uncle, is the clan leader.
Yes.
And he knows the plan, that the plan was to show up and kill everybody.
Okay.
Because she says this ain't a juke joint. It's a massacre or something. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But regardless, it's a weird time for them to show up. I don't mind that sequence. I do think it's another thing that it's just like, I don't know. I feel like this is a really, I don't know if I would ever, if I was like a screenplay teacher, a screenwriting teacher, I don't know if. I would be of two minds about teaching this screenplay, because on the one hand, I think it's really, really good as far as setting up the time and the place in a way that is not drawn a ton of attention to. Like, there's a lot of really great details in it, such like the fact that they pay with the wooden nickels, the fact that they are... this is an interesting detail that I never would have really known the specifics of, but the Chinese couple who own the two stores, that's something that was very prevalent at the time, and specifically they own two stores because one's on the white side of the street, one's on the black side of the street. And so, like, that kind of stuff, like setting that whole scene, that world building, I think is great. The implication of the World War I stuff. However, I think it breaks a lot of what would be considered basic screenwriting things by giving you so many elements that seem like they're setups to be paid off in the third act that just completely disappear because vampires show up. For instance, in any other movie, the fact that they talk so much about stealing from the Irish and the Italian mob, those guys would show up at some point. the Choctaw vampire hunters, the fact that they never show up again, like not even to like kind of survey the damage and like kind of, you know, shrug their shoulders, and like the fact that they don't show up at all is very strange. And so there's like lots of bits like that where it's like these are. So, for instance, like if I'm more surprised that the clan guys show up at the end than I am that vampires in this movie, based on the way it's set up, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene, I mean, of course, it's like, taken on its own, I think it's a fun, well-done kind of action scene, and I think Smoke's death is a very beautiful death. You know, like, he when he dies, he gets to see the woman he loves and the baby that he never really got to have. And it's sort of a, you know, it's sad because he's dying, but in a way it's kind of, I think, you know, the type of death we all hope is that's how it happens, is you die and then you get to be with the people you loved the most.
Well, a fat guy bleeds out in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, we gotta have the whole scene, right? But it is such a, like, that shift is actually harder for me than the shift to vampires. Like, I have a harder time when all of a sudden it's the Rambo sequence has to happen. And it does feel weird having the Klansmen show up after all of this other stuff has already happened.
Especially when, you know, if you're going by what the movie's talking about and you've got this we're not so different, you and I thing they're setting up with the black people and the Irish people, and they have a common enemy of oppression,
right?
Who is ostensibly the Klan. The fact that they show up after everything else is gone and not like in the middle of it, so everybody can get in on killing the oppressors, is a little weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's really strange to kind of hold that back and not throw them into the mix in the middle of the chaos, which might, maybe in practice it would be way too muddled and have way too much going on at once. But I think...
Amanda, go ahead.
Oh, no, just I think it would have been like Clay was saying, like it would have heightened that feeling of like, ah, yes, now here are the bad people. They're the really bad ones. We're not so bad. We'll help you get rid of them. Like,
but the vampires, two thirds of the vampires are clan, right? Like that's why I don't view the vampire. Go ahead.
Well, I mean,
wait,
one of the clan, I mean, of the original three, you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I assume his wife is clan sympathetic.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, once they become a vampire, they're more vampire than clan.
I guess the
vampires are not clan sympathetic. I would say.
No, Remick even specifically says that he is going to, when he's done with everybody at the Duke, and he's brought them all into his little vampire hive mind, that they'll go find the clansmen and they will, quote unquote, rectify them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So I think it's sort of like Remick's vampirism is an all consuming force. Like whatever you were before, whatever your affiliations and your sympathies were before are overwritten. And now you're just part of this, which is why the whole cornbread keeps saying, but we are one people. We're one people. Like that's.
Yep.
I think that's sort of what it's trying to say. Is it's wiping out these other identifiers between people.
Yeah, how can we avoid the Star Trek reference? They are the Borg. They're being played as the Borg, and like
much more better dance moves than the Borg generally.
Yeah, the tight-fitting metal costumes.
Do the Borg only do the robot?
Probably, you know, that's the one thing they've never done is you've never seen a Borg dance.
I thought you were just both going to give me full silence on that.
That's one. Actually, I can actually see that happening in the new Star Trek show.
Oh, I guarantee someone's going to be like, well, if you had finished Voyager, you'd know that in season six.
Which race on Star Trek is the best dancer?
Who's the one with the eye who gets his eye pulled out in Picard?
Oh, Eldris or something. I forget what his name is. Yes, but yeah, yes, that guy.
Yeah, that guy. I bet he dances.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean the vampires are just all consuming Borg. Like, you know, it is literally the Borg where it's like you assimilate everything and it becomes just this like better version of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess that's it. Like. I have a harder time with the clan stuff at the end just because I don't see that alliance between the vamp. Like I understand this is just like a like hypothetical of what should have happened or could have happened, but I don't see the alliance there between the vampires and the clan too much. And I feel that the clan sequence at the end is just a like. It feels like a blaxploitation homage that. The closest analogy, right, would be Inglourious Bastards.
I was just
right?
going like, to say, you don't make a World War II movie without killing a bunch of Nazis.
Well, the thing about like Inglourious Bastards is like, I guess I could see defenders of this saying like, this is no different than the ending of Inglourious Bastards, but Inglourious Bastards was like building to that cathartic moment, really. And this just feels like, let's shoot Klansmen because everyone hates the Klan and therefore everyone's just going to like clap their hands when this happens. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of stupid. It's a weird way to end the movie. I think like, obviously they have the post credit sequence, but I just, it felt like he was like, Coogler came to the end. He's like, oh, I wanted to add a little bit more blaxploitation elements to this. Like, how can I do this at the end? We'll kill the Klan. And the Klan up to that point felt very, ethereal, like it was just something that was in the ether, and to literalize as a bunch of guys feels like the wrong thing to do.
Also, it felt a little bit to me like they were kind of like, well, we need to kill Smoke somehow.
Yeah, sure, yeah, he's gotta go. Yeah,
we need to get rid of him by the end of this movie, and not we vampire. Don't want we don't want his brother to have done it, and for some reason I think the way to go would have been to have him die defeating Remick and saving Sammy. but instead we're gonna wait and we're gonna do this whole other like action hero sequence and then he's gonna die.
I mean, it's shitty, you know, and it anyway. Sucks, but it's like the lynching is the callback, right?
Oof. That's a dark ending.
That'd be pretty fucking dark.
That's what I mean about the stylized nature of this. Like, it's sort of playing with these ideas, but it's not really willing to go the whole nine yards with it. And it's like that's dark, but that's the thematically correct way that this ends, I think, right?
Well, like, I don't think this movie's going for like gritty realism, though.
Yeah,
I was saying that because I was arguing. I think at an earlier point, you guys were kind of saying like this is kind of like that era is being portrayed correctly, and I don't think it is being portrayed like accurately.
Well, it's more like I was saying, it's Coogler portraying it with the reverence that he has for it more than specific. Like I think that ending is probably cathartic for him, you know, more than it is as a story beat, which I think is worth something in and of itself. But yeah, I probably wouldn't have done it that way. I think there's probably better ways to do it. You know, like I said, if I was going to do that, I would probably have them show up midway through the vampire stuff and get completely wrecked by both sides of the coin there. Mm. just to wrap it up, would you guys call this a folk horror movie?
Well, we don't want to talk about the very ending.
The Buddy Guy sequence?
Yeah.
Yeah. We could talk about that. I love Buddy Guy. Not a great actor. And the one thing that this movie has a lot of, which is for some reason a real pet peeve of mine, is I really hate watching actors in a movie pretend to be like vibing to music.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like watching them like kind of like bobbing their head. I don't know what it is, but I hate it. It always feels really disingenuous to me.
Mm.
I didn't like Jordan and Steinfeld's portrayal of cool guys.
Oh, come on. That sweater's incredible, man.
That Fresh Prince of Bel-Air sweater.
He's got like the 1992? Four ring. The four ring, yeah. Like it says stack or whatever, smoke or whatever the fuck is on his hand.
Yeah, I read somewhere that he looks very similar to Radio Raheem from Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do the Right Thing. In the schizophrenic thing that I think the movie is, I thought that the ending there is necessary, and I wouldn't have made it a post-credit sequence because I think it makes a better point than what the rest of the movie is doing.
It is,
I think.
It is the first post-credit scene that is completely important to the film that came before it.
Yeah.
I just think it sums up. It makes a better, more universal, and less contentious point about that being like the importance of music to them at that point and like how they can't relive that moment again. And like, it's not like you don't want the vampire curse of living forever. The music lives forever and not you. And that's the thing that matters about this. Like your legacy isn't defined by you continuing. And you know, the era of like when they were doing their art and creating the thing that everyone is going to remember them for, that was the best time of their life. I find that to be much more sympathetic and interesting and convincing than all of the arguments that the movie makes before it. So it's a shame to me that it's a post-credit sequence because I actually turned it off not realizing that it was there, and I went back in the morning and I rewatched it. I realized there were like 15 minutes left, and I was like, how can there be 15 minutes of credits?
Yeah, you're like, wait a minute. Yeah.
Well, it takes.
No, I totally agree. I wish that scene was not like. It feels weird to tack it on like that because it is heartwarming and it is kind of gives you that. I don't want to say like so like happy ending necessarily, but kind of happy ending of seeing that Sammy kind of found the third way, right?
Yeah.
Like he found the way to go out into the world and like share his talent and his ability in a way that was like positive and productive and added something to society rather than either just consuming like the vampires were or limited.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that.
I do have to say that the sequence where Buddy Guy is playing like an electrified blues song during the credit sequence is possibly the worst syncing of action to music that I've ever seen in my life. It's really, I understand if Buddy Guy's extremely old, but it's like every music video is a little bit off sync of what the music is doing versus what the actors and the band are doing in the video. Mm. And that it's the extreme example of that. Mm.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to talk about, we didn't really spend much time on that dance hall sequence, but the thing that I find so incredible about that sequence is, like, I guarantee 9 out of 10 people read that script and get to that part and go, oh, this is going to be so fucking lame. Like, on the page, I bet it sounds really stupid. And I had heard someone describe it, and I was like, oof. Well, I don't know about that. But once it gets going, incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, the way that they executed that thing is absolutely incredible. I think it works amazingly well. And also, apparently, when the roof of the place burns down, they actually burned the roof down. So that was the very last thing that they shot in the Juke Joint set, was they actually set the roof on fire.
Oh, interesting.
Just for whatever reason, it was the only way they could get the shot. I don't know what I can't remember the exact explanation was, but it was like, this is the only way we can do this. So they set up 2 cameras pointed up at the ceiling and then just like set off explosives and lit the thing on fire. Hmm. Which I am happy to hear, because that's what we need more of that going
real
forward.
Fire.
Real fire on real bodies. Speaking of, the best part about the big vampire big battle at the end is I can't remember her name.
The vampire fight. Sorry.
Yeah, the vampire fight.
Are you talking about Grace?
Yes, when she jumps onto her husband and they both set on fire as she's stabbing
Burned
him repeatedly in the chest.
Yeah.
That was
screaming,
awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I want more of that. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Aside
it's
from
like,
that...
We're going to do this. Let's do this big.
Yeah. Aside from that, it's pretty standard vampire stuff. Like, not that different from Dusk Till Dawn or even Buffy. For more blood than Buffy, but not that different.
Yeah.
I like it when they did more interesting stuff with the vampire things, but... Yeah, would you guys call this a folk horror movie? Because I would.
I'd call it a horror movie. What makes it? Sorry, what makes it folk? I guess.
Amanda, you're the expert. Would you like to?
Oh God, don't call me the expert. I'm not an expert in anything.
Oh, well, now you're the expert.
I mean, I also think it's a folk horror movie, and I think part of that is the way it's presented with that sort of opening voiceover with the art and talking about the histories and traditions of these different peoples. I think weaving in Annie's like spiritual background that originates from their homelands and their original culture makes part of it a folk movie. I think, I don't know. I think the setting has a lot to do with it too, where you are very much in this, stylized and heightened version, but this very specific kind of place. You're not like that. This could only really happen this way in the American South,
right? Yeah,
in that general time period, it's not something that you'd see the exact same story playing out, you know, in other places.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah,
a lot of stylistic, like subgenre stylistic choices too.
Yeah, I also think that's one of the things that bugs me so much about the switch to just vampires, because it's much more in line with a folk horror thing if they stick with the cultural evil, cultural monster, than just going to vampire.
Yeah, it does wobble away from it when it gets more into just like, we're doing Hollywood vampires now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I could see the argument either way,
yeah,
to be honest, but I tend to lean towards, I think it's a folk horror movie.
I would be remiss if we didn't mention Ludvig Göransson, who did the music for this, man, that guy's a beast. The music for this is incredible. Like the blending scene to scene with the music, the score of this is so good. And it's been so interesting to watch that guy's career, because he did the music for Community, the TV show.
And wait, what?
Yeah, he was the guy who did the music for Community. And he has been just like working his way up the ladder. And now he's doing this. I think he did the music for Oppenheimer, too. So he's been doing these big scores, and he does really great stuff. He plays like a million instruments.
His name is Ludwig.
Yep. And they got together.
Has to live up to that.
Yeah, you got it. It's you're destined.
They got together. Yeah. Traditional Irish choral groups and traditional African choral groups to both blend in singing these different songs and stuff, and it's very, very cool. This is number 12 on our list. How do you guys feel about that placement? I have a feeling we're all three shouldn't be number 12.
We're standard deviations away from the 12.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it should be number 12. I don't even know if I'd put it on the list, honestly. Like, I understand why it's there, but it's too new for me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Scariness ever? This is the one of the least scary horror movies I've ever seen in my life.
Very scary. Yeah. Yeah.
That is whenever we do this, Wes, the things that I tend to focus on are like, was it scary at all? And/or did it have like a big impact? Because there are some movies that have popped up on this list where, like, especially if they were older movies, watching them now, it's like not as scary, but it's had either a big impact on other films or a big impact culturally. Like when we covered The Blob, it's like The Blob is objectively not scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, it's everyone just ubiquitous it. In. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. So it has that sort of longevity and that staying power. I don't know about this one. I really enjoy this movie. Mm. Like, I really like it. I like watching it. It's beautiful to look at. The music's great. I think the performances are well done, but I don't know if that qualifies it as one of the 200 best horror movies of all time.
Yeah.
I don't know. If you told me this was like 98, I'd be like, meh. I mean 198. Sorry, yeah. I'd sort of be like, yeah, I'll give it to you, but
yeah, the,
I probably
once you,
wouldn't
once
fight
you,
for it.
Once you start getting to the end of 200, you're like, I guess like it could just fit on.
Yeah,
sure.
That back 50, back 50 is a real you know, crapshoot of what you're gonna get.
It's just you don't know what you're gonna wake up next to.
Everything's a surprise and everything makes sense.
I mean, I wouldn't put, I mean, I would be the same. Maybe it's in the back end of a 200s, but it's not something that I would ever consider to be like an all-timer for me. I wouldn't recommend this movie, I don't think. I actually disagree with you guys about Paranormal Activity. Well, this is not that movie, but I thought you guys were both kind of low on that one. I would have gone much higher on that one, so that'll be the difference. I'll go high on Paranormal Activity, and I'll go low on this one.
Oh, you'd put it higher on the list, like closer to
Paranormal
one?
Paranormal Activity is like probably top 20 horror movie for me, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do you think this will win any of the 16 nominations it has?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's...
Do you think it'll win the Best Picture one?
I don't know any of the other movies.
That's true. You did say that at the top. Yeah, that's an unfair question.
Do I still have it here? I thought I think I lost it.
You know, this. Can I? While you look up your thing, can I have a minute to speak about something here?
Sure.
I would. This to me is a very, very poor man's Get Out. Which is that it's kind of dealing with similar issues. I thought that Get Out was much more clever and much more thoughtful and much more novel in what it was saying than what this movie is saying about things. They're not exactly the same, but I think that Get Out really does something new with this idea about like... cultural interactions, and this one treads much more towards traditional academy bait in that it's a much more general battle between the races kind of thing. And Get Out was much more subtle and sympathetic to making an argument about like smaller issues between groups. And Get Out is like I see reality in Get Out, and I see no reality in this movie whatsoever. But I do feel that this is the kind of movie that the Academy is going to reward for. It will see it as this is the right thing to do, is to support this movie and to give it a lot of nominations. I don't think it would win Best Picture. I'd be shocked if it would. I'd be upset if it won Screenplay or Best Actor, really. Mm. But everything else is kind of whatever they want to do.
I think One Battle After Another is going to win Best Picture.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too.
I hope PTA wins Best Director. Yeah, I think Michael B. Jordan is a long shot for Best Actor. Like that's a pretty stacked. You've got
He's up against competition.
Yeah, Timothy Chalamet.
Is stacked, Clay.
Yeah,
is
that's
stacked.
True. Timothy Chalamet. But do they get to vote twice because he plays two characters?
Oh, he does. for this one. I thought you were talking about Chalamet. I was like, I thought that's a ping pong movie or something, but yeah, okay.
it is a ping pong.
Timothy Chalamet, Leonardo DiCaprio, Ethan Hawke, Michael B. Jordan, and Wagner Moura, who's, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but he's, I haven't seen that movie, The Secret Agent, but he's a really good actor. He's I've seen him in a bunch of stuff.
Go ahead.
He was in Narcos. He played, what the hell's the big famous drug dealer in Narcos was him. Name I can't remember.
Narcos.
Yeah, the Netflix show about drug.
Oh, that I was thinking of something. I was thinking of something else there. Okay, so Get Out one.
Like the way you said that, Narcos.
Narcos. Get Out one screenplay.
It did. Okay. Yeah.
It was nominated for Best Picture, Director, and Actor. Okay.
Having not seen it, but having heard how much everybody likes it, I bet One Battle After Another wins Best Picture. I bet Marty Supreme wins a screenplay.
Okay.
If this doesn't win, I think this is pretty high on the list for cinematography, pretty high on the list for costume design, pretty high on the list for sound.
Yeah, it'll win music and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
I think it probably original score as well. But I will come back to this and rethink its place on the list if the fact that this and Frankenstein are both Best Picture nominees this year, despite the fact that I didn't love Frankenstein, open the door for more horror stuff in the future to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a doofy thing to say, but it always gets the, like, Sinners being considered a Best Picture movie is huge, because they never do that. You know, like, for even Frankenstein had to be a Guillermo del Toro Oscar movie after he won one for something else in order to get on there. Sinners is closer to like an exploitation movie than anything else.
Like, I don't know. Like, obviously, it has to be a horror movie that tickles the Academy's fancy, right? Like, it's not going to be just The Shining that wins an Academy Award. You know what I mean?
Well, the only one that's really made much of a dent was Silence of the Lambs, and even that one is debatable as to whether when it was that year, they did not call it a horror movie, but a lot of people do.
Yeah, it probably still wouldn't, but yeah, I mean, that's I don't know. I'm always torn. It's like I don't really care what the Academy decides about these things, but I always think that the Academy is only interesting 5 years in the future when you look back at what happened.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. As like a historical record.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, the Academy has a soft spot for certain kinds of movies. Like, this kind of movie is squarely in what the Academy thinks that it should recognize as something. Crash is that way. Like, when Hollywood thinks
Crash is
God
awful.
But when Hollywood thinks that something important is being said, they reward the movie regardless of whether or not it deserves to be rewarded that way. And you know, it's only with the benefit of hindsight and time passing that you can look back and go like, oh, that was a weird year, or that was a good year. Like,
yeah,
you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess
it's
we'll
rare.
See.
It's rare the best picture wins. Like, what, the best picture probably wins like less than 30% of the time. Probably, really, if you go back and like define movies by what you think is like what should have won in the history, it's hard to say.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's it gets tough because a lot of that is obviously very subjective. But there are some years where you're like, no, this wasn't it.
I mean, the Crash. Crash is the thing. Like, yeah. Crash. Yeah. Crash yeah. was. Crash was the Academy taking its opinions about the world more important than what it thought was the best product that it created that year.
Well, that one's so ironic, too, because if you watch that movie, the stuff that it thinks it's saying is completely insane. Like, yeah. It's trying to make a point, but in making that point, it is also subverting the point it's trying to make,
yeah,
completely negating anything smart. And it's just garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's like, you know, it's like, you don't, it's like Black Panther was the first Marvel movie nominated, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
There's a history of like 10 years of like any, you know, there's like any of these kinds of movies usually get nominated quite powerfully, no matter how good they are. And like, I don't like Black Panther. It's just an interesting choice that was the first Marvel movie that got any kind of traction with anybody. Yeah.
And it's not always racial stuff. Like, I mean, I don't know. I think probably
It's like a mental handicapped and racial stuff. Or like,
well, no, I was gonna say
Nazis.
Heath Ledger getting the nomination for the Joker is probably 85% the fact that he died.
Sure,
you know, as great as great as that performance is, that's not something that they would usually. Yeah. I think Did Chadwick Boseman get a posthumous nomination for something as well? I don't know. Anyway, it helps your chances if you die.
It does. It does. Yeah. Posthumous award. Let me see. He got a primetime Emmy. What the fuck? Okay.
He was never on a TV show, but we think if he had lived long enough to be on one,
he would have been
great.
I don't know what year he got that in 2022. I don't know what year he passed away, but he got a posthumous star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 25.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. There hasn't been a ton of posthumous Oscars. I think the guy from Network is the only other one I can think of, but yeah, it's a weird thing. It's completely arbitrary. Yeah. It's fun pomp and circumstance, and you know.
What's your opinion about Oscars having 10 nominations? Is this the right decision that we made 15 years ago?
I think so. I heard somewhere that for Best Picture, it doesn't have to be 10, but it can be up to 10.
Okay.
And if that's the case, I wish they would use that option to not be 10 more often, because I don't think, like, did we really need to put F1 on here? I don't think so.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I haven't. So how many are there? There are 10 this year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think 5 is. When you go back to the list when they had 5, you're like, why is this movie on here? You know, like they clearly struggle to get 5. I think, and maybe it's just the. Although this all happened before COVID, I was thinking then maybe there's COVID. They're just like desperate to get people to watch the movies, so they want the thing. But this happened well before COVID, so who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think is it actually opening things up and getting more people interested? I mean, if that's the case, then sure, why not? I don't give a shit. Yeah. Give them as many as you want. But like, does it lessen the importance of the thing? Does it make it less exclusive? And then for, I don't know, I guess it's really personal how you feel about it, I guess. But
I always I always want the awards to represent the right thing, or at least to get like directionally right. I feel that that's, I don't know, it's kind of like, I don't know why I feel like it's important, but I feel like it should be important. Mm-hmm. And occasionally just like some awards are obviously never correct about anything. Like the Emmys are kind of a joke, or the Golden Globes or whatever. But it's like, I feel like the Academy Award should at least get directionally right about what they've decided to do. But
yeah, it's
I have never given a shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I enjoy the show and I enjoy the whatever, but yeah, it doesn't, like, if you, like you were saying, Wes, if you go back and you look at the history of it, It would be nice if they got it right, but most of the time they don't.
Yeah.
And I don't think that necessarily is a bad... It doesn't hurt the movies in the long run. The good movies always win out.
Yeah, they do. And they do. And obviously a lot of my favorite movies are not Academy Award-winning nominees, yeah. But yeah.
I had a period of time where I wanted to try and win a Grammy because I figured... I figured of all of the big name brand awards you could win, that was probably the easiest.
Mm-hmm. Because not a Tony. You're not just going to go out on stage and do your one.
No, I don't tap dance well enough. But I was like, Grammys, the categories are so weird that I feel like I could probably figure one out and get like a, you know, best spoken word performance in a repertory reading of a Dickens novel or some shit like that.
Yeah.
Just hand in a voicemail.
Extremely specific.
Yeah, exactly. Extremely specific voicemail. Best spoken word on a voicemail left on a Grammy voter's phone.
left on a wrong. There we go. Left there on a is. Wrong phone call.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. I think that's going to do it for us with Sinners. I'm going to hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, boop, beep, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. And next time, we will be covering Duel from 1971 by one Mr. Steven Spielberg.
All right.
Which I have never seen.
I have not either.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to
it. I don't think I've ever heard of that.
Yeah, it was his... second movie. It's one of those ones where I believe it was a TV movie, but since it was Spielberg, it's been retroactively counted as like a legitimate one.
Yeah, don't they try to say that Duel is the reason why he was able to make Jaws?
Yeah, something like that. I think they are kind of similar movies because Duel is about a giant truck that is hunting people,
boxing a giant fish.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. David Mann, a mild-mannered electronic salesman, is driving cross-country on a two-lane highway when he encounters an old... Sorry, I had to click more.
An old what?
An old oil tanker driven by an unseen driver who seems to enjoy annoying him with dangerous antics on the road. Unable to escape the demonic big rig, David finds himself in a dangerous game of cat and mouse with the monstrous truck. When the pursuit escalates to deadly levels, David must summon his inner warrior... and turn the tables on his tormentor.
There we go. We can just clip this, and part of my job for next week is done.
Yes.
Thanks, Clay.
But yeah, that's going to do it for us.
Sorry, can I ask one question while I'm just looking at the Academy Award list? So did you guys see the movie Anora last year?
No.
Yes.
I wanted to, but I haven't seen it yet.
What do you think of directors who have multiple movies all about sex work? What do you think that says about the person?
It sounds like he's using it as a write-off. Is what it sounds like.
I find that super super interesting that you're just like I'm gonna master this sex work movie 17 times out and just get this done. But it's fascinating.
I mean, if it ain't broke, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it's,
you're gonna get there one day.
You find yourself fascinated in a certain crevice of society.
You just keep Jeffrey Epstein's mail list. Yeah.
Keep plugging away at it, and no matter how much money it costs you.
Sorry,
you just really insert yourself in a certain cleavage, and
yeah, there you go.
Stay there.
Yeah,
that's got an R rating on this podcast. I think
you should have taken a
just
pass.
Just now, you guys were talking earlier.
We never got back to the cunnilingus thing.
I was just going to say, Amanda, you should have taken a pass at the dialogue and its Sinners.
Why? How come? Yeah, there's, I, how much? How, why is there
call
so
me
much?
Coogler.
Why is there so much cunnilingus in this movie? Like, not
vampires have oral fixations.
Is that it?
I don't know. I'm being facetious.
I don't really care, but it was like it made a point that this was the thing that they were going to discuss for a little bit in multiple scenes.
Yeah, I was waiting for the plot point to hinge on it.
Yeah, I don't.
It is one of those things that I've always found kind of hacky. I think it works better here than most of the times, but like if ever you need your characters to say something that is going to make you go, oh, then you just have. You know, someone talk about like, oh, you know, did you ever think about like if you had a clone, if you like fuck your own clone, is that basically like masturbating? Like I saw that in something once and I was like, oh, boy.
Yeah. Bring it back for another pass.
Oh, boy. Anyway,
I just thought it was it was a weird detail in this, like not just sex. Well, I mean, there, I guess there's a, because the only person, no, he has sex with, does he have sex with Mary at the end?
Is yeah, that when he gets turned into a vampire.
Okay, so they do have, I was going to say, because he only seems to have sex with the mother of his child, but I guess that's not the case.
That actually.
Yeah, there's a bunch of sex scenes.
Yeah, that actually
What's
is.
What's the other sex scene?
It's when Sammy.
When Sammy goes down on Pearlie.
Yeah. Oh, but that's what I mean, like penetrative P&V sex.
You want to see full pen, is what you're saying.
I'm just saying the
guys, we got to wrap this up.
Coogler made a decision about when he was just going to have some muff diving happen, and when he was.
Well, I was just thinking the oral sex is a pivotal plot point when it comes to the history of Mary and Stack, because he's like, oh yeah, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, then you stuck your tongue in between my legs. It's like,
yes,
oh, okay,
yeah.
No, it's a key.
Yeah,
it's a key turning point.
It changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you guys for listening. If you want to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/PenskyFile and follow Amanda and I as we talk about some sequels. January was Gremlins, which I still have not put up yet. Hopefully it'll be up by the time this goes up. February is Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes, that is true, which is my favorite Hammer movie, so that's going to be fun to talk about. And, follows for the rest of the year as we do that. Thank you, Wes, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. How is that Dracula movie a sequel?
It is part of the Christopher Lee set of Dracula movies.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so it's like not a sequel by number, but just in the same franchise.
Gotcha, understand.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you, Clay. Thanks for joining us, Wes.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye.